Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm studying the myths and religions of the world and seeing what inspiration we can find in them for fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are concluding our brief season on Tengrism, the religion that was so important to the Mongol Empire in the Middle Ages, but that was also found in many other civilizations throughout the Central Asian region. Going back into antiquity. Today is a wrap-up episode where I talk about what I've learned studying Tengrism and also share a terrible thought that's been stuck in my head for a while and that now you get to listen to. So let's start with my terrible thought. I was thinking about the idea of the Mongols as the wrath of God, right? Now, that's an idea that appears in some writing about Genghis Khan, the idea that he calls himself a punishment from heaven. So the reason that, you know, all these civilizations are being devastated is because they have, you know, sinned or turned their backs on heaven in some way. And this is an idea that I think was originally applied to Attila, you know, some, whatever, nearly 1,000 years before Genghis. And that made me think of the sort of other divine punishments, right? So the idea of plagues, for instance. Of course, one plague that was greatly feared by the agrarian civilizations of the ancient Near East was locusts, plagues of locusts. And I personally have never seen a locust swarm, but my understanding is that they're pretty impressive. You can understand both why someone would think of them as a plague, some kind of divine punishment, because it's not just like, oh, there's more locusts around than usual. It's either the locusts are completely out of control or, oh no, the locusts are destroying everything. So you might feel that way, I suppose, about the Mongols if you were a settled agrarian society, that they were, you know, trampling under their horses' hooves. And similarly, you might compare the vast numbers of the Mongol army to a swarm of locusts. Obviously, thinking of people as insects, not amazing, but, you know, the power relationship is kind of the other way around on that one. And so I was thinking of the leader of such a thing, because, of course, the thing about a swarm of locusts is that it doesn't have a leader. It's not like a queen bee situation. Actually, you know, maybe it is. I don't know anything about locusts. So I was just thinking, you know, maybe the leader is just going to be the biggest and strongest, the most powerful and most authoritative of all locusts. Some particularly huge locust is going to be our analog to the Great Khan. And so, and then I was thinking, like, how would I describe this exceptionally large and imposing, you know, this Khan of the locusts? And so into my mind came the only possible name for this character, Bug Chinggis. If you are either older enough or younger enough than me that you don't get that joke, good for you. If you are of my cohort and you understand how bad that joke is, I'll get my coat. Anyway, I couldn't not let Bug Chinggis out of my brain and onto the airwaves. I do apologize, but that's how terrible jokes work. Anyway, this has been an especially challenging season in terms of research. I think I probably feel less qualified to speak about Tengrism than about any of the faiths and pantheons that we've talked about so far. With some pantheons, it's because there aren't a lot of works that have been translated. So, and that might be the case for Tengrism. It didn't seem like there were very many translations, although I did have a good one of The Secret History of the Mongols. There was one for the Orkhon inscriptions, but it seemed like a lot of the writing about Tengrism had been done in Russian or in Chinese or indeed in Mongolian. So the sources were a challenge. It kind of reinforced my desire not to bag on Jim Ward for the quality of his research in Deities and Demigods. I endorse that specific wording. And because this has, you know, pantheons and deities are like any other aspect of history or culture when translated into games. This past week, I've been in Edinburgh talking to students at the Edinburgh Futures Institute who are studying history and games design. And in my talk, I mentioned one of the challenges. I've seen this both in role-playing games and in miniature war games, but it's true in any kind of game. But, you know, maybe RPGs most of all, which is that history provides questions, it provides ambiguity, it provides probabilities, but game design and game settings require definite answers. Or if they don't require them, certainly they would quite like them. And so the designer or the writer of a supplement, something like Deities and Demigods, needs to take all these different possibilities and condense them into a single thing where you can look at the page and say, ah, this is so-and-so, and he is the god of the air, which will almost always be an oversimplification of the complex role that that deity played in that culture, but there's no other way to do it if you want to fit that deity into the terms of the game. Now, you might ask yourself, do you want to fit that deity into the terms of the game? One of the things that I think Tengrism revealed to me, and, you know, adapting Tengrism to a gaming context revealed to me, was some of the challenges of what gets included and what gets left out. I'll talk about that in a second. Another thing that this season has really done, I think, has been a great look at the way religions, for the most part, and in most parts of the world, aren't kind of bounded phenomena. There's been a lot of discussion lately, a lot of argument about the concept of so-called cultural Christianity. So cultural Christianity is this idea of a kind of basic level of Christian-influenced thinking that occurs in cultures where quite a lot of people in that society are Christians. Cultural Christianity can manifest in things like public policy. So an example of this would be even kids who aren't Christian in the United States don't have to go to school on Christmas. There's basically only one religion, which is kind of verging on the secular. Or, for example, even people who are not particularly Christians, when they see something surprising, might say, Jesus Christ. Those are kind of superficial cultural manifestations of cultural Christianity, but I do think that there are more important kind of, well, at least for our purposes in this show, more important. Obviously, which days your kids are in school is very important if, say, you're a parent. For our purposes on this show, very important manifestations of cultural Christianity in terms of the way that we think about religion. Now, I know I'm being a bit of a broken record. I've said this many times before, but I think it is just the case that people who are raised in a culture where one religion is the norm have a tendency to think that most religions are like that religion, like they're different in terms of their doctrine and they're different in terms of their practices. They may even be different in terms of their structure, but they're similar in terms of what they are. And I think that's probably not the case. So to give you an example of what I'm talking about, Tengrism does not seem to be a bounded religion like Christianity is. You can debate the edge cases, but in general, in Christianity, people either are or are not Christians. Like, if you asked somebody, are you a Christian, they will say yes or no. Their idea of what that might mean is different, so people don't agree on where exactly the boundaries of Christianity are, but is understood to be bounded. And I think that people who come from culturally Christian backgrounds, like me, maybe have a tendency to at least initially think about other religions with analytical concepts that maybe only make sense, or at least make most sense, when applied to Christianity. And what we've seen when we looked at other religions from around the world on this show is that they seem to be more permeable, or indeed, it's not even so much that they're permeable, right? Permeable means like you could get in and out of their boundaries, but more that they don't necessarily have those boundaries. An example of this would be Shinto, where it just would not be at all uncommon for people to participate in both Shinto and Buddhist practices. I was thinking of this in the context of China, actually, because, as you know, if you listen to my bonus episodes, I've just finished reading The Romance of the Three Kingdoms. And one of the ways in which The Romance of the Three Kingdoms is different from The Water Margin, which is the previous season, well, it's actually the subsequent, but I listened to it first, season of the Chinese Lore podcast, is that the kind of default religious or spiritual or philosophical understandings in The Romance of the Three Kingdoms are Taoist and Confucian, and Buddhists turn up, but kind of only in special contexts. By contrast, in The Water Margin, the default understanding is Buddhist. Most of the like monks and clerics that you meet are Buddhist, and Taoism only appears in the context of sorcery. There's a scene in which all the heroes of Liangshan, so all 108 of them, go to visit this abbot to pay their respects. It's not 108, some of them are dead by this point, but you know, all of them except one, except for Gongsunsheng, who's the token Taoist in the bunch. Even Dai Zongo's, I think, and he's a Taoist for sure. But Gongsunsheng is a Taoist priest. Now, I mean, some of the heroes of Liangshan are proper Buddhists. They might not be very good Buddhists, but they're definitely official Buddhists, like Lu Jishen, who's a Buddhist monk, a bad one, but he is one. But the majority of them are just going to go pay their respects to someone that they see as holy and wise and venerable, someone that they need to show respect for, even though they may not be like fully paid up, full-time members of his faith. And it's only the religious specialist, Kang Sun Sheng, who stays away because that would like contravene the restrictions that his faith places on him, but not apparently any of the like lay, I guess, practitioners of that faith. Which is a very roundabout way, sorry, I didn't think of a good way to say it concisely. This is a very roundabout way of saying that Tengrism seems to be more inclusive in that respect. And I was thinking to myself, well, how does one implement this in a role-playing game? And then I thought, you know, I feel like most religious practices in RPGs are kind of already like this. This actually is sort of how people view things, where these faiths all coexist. They don't necessarily make claims about which one is quote-unquote true, and if you are nominally a worshiper of one of them, or if there is even such a thing as being nominally a worshiper of one of them, and you decide to go and patronize a temple of another one, nobody really is going to make a big deal out of it. Even in something like Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, where there is this very clear kind of Catholic-Protestant divide between people who worship Ulric, the older, more traditional religion practiced in one part of the empire, mainly by a kind of regional minority, and people who practice the new religion of Sigmar. People who worship Sigmar and people who worship Ulric don't deny that the other god exists. They just are competing about the, like, privileges and rights of their various religious denominations. I know that Games Workshop would eventually introduce another Reformation analog in the person of the character Luthor Hus, the pious, reforming Sigmarite cleric who wanted to clear out the corruption and privilege of the Sigmarite church. But, you know, these symbols can recur multiple times. Another thing that really stood out about Tengrism was the way that it represented a mix of influences that I think I, at least, and probably most of my listeners, were not all that familiar with. And we saw this with Native American mythology as well. There are certain mythoi, there are certain sets of myths that are more familiar to people within the English-speaking world. And those include like Greek and Roman myth, Norse myth. I think to a certain extent, people are familiar with quote-unquote Celtic quote-unquote myth. I think Chinese and Japanese sources have become like a little bit more well-known in the English-speaking world, largely because of the proliferation of Chinese and Japanese media, even if it's just through things like video games and kung fu movies. I feel like they are a little bit better known than they used to be, but there are some that we don't know very much about, and by which I don't mean that like their secrets are lost or anything, but I mean that they just don't really turn up in kind of Western media. And one of those, weirdly enough, apart from like stories about coyote, is Native American mythology, but Tengrism is kind of another one. There was a very large religious community that had a lot of people in it, but most people couldn't even tell you what it was. Like, if you said, what religion was Genghis Khan? Most people would go like, Buddhist, I guess? Now, that's not because this is a region that's like quote-unquote peripheral. Indeed, I think that most people, you know, if you had to say which of Western Europe and Central Asia was peripheral during the High Middle Ages, you'd have to say Western Europe. But actually, I don't think it's that either. I don't think that really matters. But we are used to thinking, most of us, of the Middle Ages as being something that happens in Europe, and we find that habit very hard to shake. I remember being given a book to read when I was becoming an early medievalist. I asked a very prominent medievalist for some reading recommendations, and one of the books she gave me purported to be a history of early medieval Europe, but it was really a history of early medieval France. The word Poland didn't appear in it anywhere. And you think, oh, these places were cut off from the rest of Europe. Like, no, they weren't. I can think of at least one king of England in the early Middle Ages who was half Polish. But regardless, those habits, in terms of what we think of as, quote-unquote, the Middle Ages, are hard to shake. It's also hard to know, I think, when we're studying a particular religion, what to focus on and what to exclude. So my initial instinct is to look at the social aspects, to look at the political aspects, to look at the way in which, for example, Tengri is used to legitimate the rule of different, you know, ruling families or clans, different polities that are ascendant over other ones. That's just kind of my go-to. That's the first thing that I think of is, you know, what are the political aspects of this? There are other approaches, right? The deities and demigods style approach is to focus very much on the divine genealogy, to look for the different deities and their different areas of responsibility and their different powers, to treat it as a cast of characters. And I think that Tengrism kind of doesn't provide you with much of that kind of material. Maybe leaving it out is the kind of thing that you would do. You looked at it and went, oh, it's kind of like a monotheistic faith. These other deities aren't super important or interesting. But how does that relate to what most people who believed in Tengri actually got out of their religion? I would guess they probably weren't super concerned about the personalities of individual gods, right? That is a pattern taken from Greek and Norse mythology. Do more people care more about these different, like, tiered heavens that we've seen appear in Tengrism? Do they care more about the afterlife? It's very interesting to me that one of the things that we haven't seen much of at all in discussing these different seasons is the afterlife, what happens to souls when they die. Because, of course, what happens to your soul when you die in Dungeons and Dragons is a little bit different from what happens in that mythology. So it may also be the case that these long lists of deities, I mean, obviously for some of the chapters it doesn't work at all, but, you know, there are mythologies that fit that better than others, but I don't think that Tengrism is one of them. Even Tengri doesn't seem to have much of what you might call a personality in terms of likes and dislikes or whatever. Tengri is much more like heaven, that somewhat abstract idea, not only of the way things are, but the way things should be. This is something that exists in my fantasy campaign. The traditionalist elven culture recognizes the existence of the gods worshipped by humans, but considers them all to be subordinate to a cosmic principle, the creator. And elves believe that it would be inappropriate for them to worship anything other than the supreme deity, the creator. And therefore, they don't concern themselves with the worship of what they consider to be petty gods, which makes the elven religion rather, like, abstract and philosophical, which is what I was going for. Since the creator doesn't have, like, a personality for you to latch on to, it's just a principle. But that kind of endorsement of existing structures and existing hierarchies is part of that faith. Thus, it was created. But of course, you know, in the other place that we're familiar with it, China, this idea of the will of heaven, of being in accordance with heaven and earth, is something that exists alongside a wide range of other religious practices devoted to different deities or spirits or whatever. And I wonder if we might not think of the various deities in Tengrism as being a little bit like that. One thing that I thought was very interesting was that other than sort of like endorsing rule through conquest, I don't think that there was that much that Tengrism did that fit with our image of the Mongols as being exceptionally warlike. You know, the European influence in the literature that inspires RPGs tends to make us see Mongols as antagonists, and even when not antagonists, as the kind of protagonists or sympathetic characters that are specifically inverted antagonists. You know, oh, these people aren't so bad. But they might have been. My argument for protagonist status has nothing to do with morality, and more just to do with, like, centrality to the story. A lot of European protagonists are a pretty nasty bunch. But so for me, it seems like the Tengrism season perhaps raises more questions than it answers. I think there's been a lot of good inspiration in this section. I think we've got a lot of fun ideas as a result of it, and I'm certainly happy that I did it. But I don't necessarily feel like I have some kind of perfect sense of what Tengrism is now. I just think that, you know, we've all found some hopefully useful, hopefully entertaining bits and pieces. Okay, so for the next few episodes, I'm going to be doing one shots, or maybe two shots, in which I talk about little topics related to religion and mythology, relevant to gaming, but not large enough to form a season of their own. And then in the middle of the spring, we're going to start a new season. It is probably going to be about Vodun or Vodun or Voodoo, depending on your pronunciation, but about the, or maybe about syncretic West African / Caribbean faiths more generally. We'll see how it works out, but I'm quite looking forward to it. This is something where the reading that I did on it was a long time ago, so I am going to have to go back and kind of refresh my memory and make sure I get everything right. It's a subject that I know is important to people, and I want to make sure that I'm not shortchanging it. But so that is what is ahead in the coming weeks, and I hope that you will join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.